Yvonne Tavenot. I am an independent change practitioner based out of Toronto, Canada. I've been in the field of change management since 2007. But in my last 10 years at corporate, my job was eliminated 7 times. And I always say that's where I got my true training in change management, both as a target as well as a steward of change. And what a delight to be here with the Change Management Institute today and 2 experts like Kat and Mick. Really looking forward to our conversation. Kat, over to you.
Thanks, Yvonne. Hi, everyone. My name's Kat Patel. I am an ACM Master with CMI. I'm also a volunteer. I look after UK collaborations for Change Management Institute here in the UK. I've been practicing change management for about 10 years. I've been in change projects transformation for probably about 20. I say 10 years because that's when I figured out actually it's a real job that other people do, not just something you do on the side of other things. And I've been working on technology implementation for pretty much the entire 20 years. And I find the term digitization generally sort of funny in itself. And I think it's become a bit of a fad, and sometimes we get swept up in it. So I'm really looking forward to talking to people who I speak to a lot on LinkedIn, Yvonne and Mick. And it's nice to be able to actually have a conversation with you guys also as well, listening in. So thanks for joining us. Mick.
Cheers, Kat. Thanks very much. Hi, everyone. My name's Mick Bryan. I live in Plymouth in the UK. So if anyone's from the US, but you know, that's where we set sail from all those years ago on the Mayflower. I was in the British Army for 24 years. And I was doing change. I just didn't know it was called that. Probably most of the time I was in the military, and I left in 2011, and then went down the usual project management sort of route, and quite quickly realized that I couldn't quite get my head around why people were spending an awful lot of money on an awful lot of things, but an awful lot of people weren't using the stuff that was being made or handed to them or whatever. So that's how I got interested in change. So I've been working in change, probably officially for about 12 years, I'd say. Currently I'm working in a change project, which is based around AI, which is quite interesting. It's probably the next level of digitization, I suppose. We might actually get on to talk about that. But that's a quick overview of my background. And like Kat said, I'm interested in the whole sort of buzzword thing around digital transformation and digitization as well, because I think I was doing digital transformation when I got ZX Spectrum when I was 12 years old. But, you know, it's just that's where it started. So, yeah, thanks very much.
Yeah, you've just said the ZX Spectrum, and I don't know how much of the audience would connect with it, maybe. I remember seeing, I went to a museum recently where they had a whole wall of old machines, phones. And my kids were like, what's this wall of stuff? I'm like, that's what computers used to look like. And they're like, but they're massive. I'm like, yeah, I know. But what's on that big thing there is like 100th or 1,000th of what your phone can do. And they're like, yeah, I love my new phone. It's funny how so much has changed, and what's visible is sort of the size and scale of things, right?
Yeah.
So maybe that gives us the segue to jump into one of the first offline tackles we had, which was about the use of the word digital. And if I think about our phones, for example, we don't call them digital phones, we call them phones. And as we've been going through this transformation, one of the things that I referred back to was, I keep files of resources. What was the oldest resource that I had in there with the tagline digital? And it dated back to 2015. And so somewhere in here, 8 years has passed, which is like, you know, a third of a generation, and we're still using this phrase digital to talk about digital transformation. And when I think about electricity, at some point, we went from calling something electrical lighting to lighting. And I wonder, and I'd love to hear, Mick, your views on this, like, when do we stop using the word digital?
When do we? And so I think we might have to define we. I don't use digital when I talk to most people being impacted by some sort of technology or, IT change. But the wider ecosystem in which we sit is a commercial one. And I think it pays to keep the narrative going. There's so many things linked to it, like how well are you doing? Like one of the articles we read, it got my attention immediately when they said, I don't know, I can't remember the exact, 70% fail to meet the intended targets. And that is an equivalent of like $300 billion a year. And I thought, what a really negative, narrow, short-sighted, inflammatory way to position what's going on. Like, transformation takes over so many different aspects of a business, happens over quite a long time and emerges. What you start out with, what you end up with, very different. So I never use the word digital. It just seems to be in the rhetoric of trying to convince organizations they should adopt more technologically smart approaches to the way they do things. Anyway, get off my high horse now.
Yeah. No, it's such a broad term as well, isn't it? It's you get a new car, the amount of digital stuff in the new car, kitchen appliances are digital, IT is digital, laptops are digital. It's such a massive, broad spectrum that covers as well. And I think sometimes then, I agree with you, Kat, it's an easy way to, it's a, such a broad term, you can put so much into it, but it can actually be quite overwhelming for you. I don't think there's any more, if you want to use that phrase, digital transformation or digitization, bigger thing for anyone really is when we started to using PCs. I remember, in fact, I was thinking about it the other day. I can't remember the actual date, but I can remember it was around the middle part of about 1995 when I first started using what would be a PC. And everything before that, we had this process. And when I was in the military, to pass orders down through the sort of chain of command, it was all handwritten or typed, and it was photocopied. I mean, that was the technology. Yeah, that was the digital. And then someone gave us all PCs, and we had the most very basic Word program. And back then, it seemed like I wouldn't say that there was no pressure to use it. Oh, let's have a go, see how I do it. Nobody was really worried about it. I think now we've made technology seem really, really difficult sometimes for people. But back then it was just, do you know what? Try it, use it, get on with it. It's very much now, I think, I'm not going to, we'll go into this probably. It's like ChatGPT. You just need to go and play with it to actually start understanding it. No one's going to teach you it.
Yeah. I'm keen on understanding whether you two use the word digital transformation in your practice when you're talking to people.
I try not to. For the same reasons. It's even that it's the transformation thing as well, isn't it? If everything was a transformation, we'd all be in such a state or in such a flux. It would just seem too overwhelming to do anything sometimes, I think.
Yvonne, do you use it?
No, but it is used, like in context of digital strategy. Most organizations I work with frame a lot of their transformational change in terms of a digital strategy or in terms of digital tools. Like they'll specifically use the phrase to describe specific tools. And when I was thinking about, okay, so language aside, what does this mean to me when we frame, you know, digital transformation, does change management need to change? I was thinking in context of sort of three buckets of area that touch the work that I do. And one is, I guess what we would call those digital transformations themselves, you know, automation, robotics, or those types of activities. There's the digitization or the use of an extended sweep of tools. So Miro is one I've started using more actively, certainly Teams and, you know, a variety of those things, ChatGPT to Nick's point, starting to emerge as a tool. And then there's the whole cultural component that just goes along with the digital way of thinking. And for me, I think that's almost the most fascinating part, because not unlike when we first started using computers, we tried to make computers be like paper. So we would use one specific screen at a time. We removed some of the capability because our brains weren't thinking in that multidimensional dynamic way. Over time now, how many of us work with only one screen at a time? And if you throw in your phone as well, you're probably working with 2 to 3 screens at any point in time. And so we trained our brain to kind of think differently because of digitization. And that's also impacted the culture, how we approach work, how we engage work. But that is just the beginning of the learning journey as well.
The part that caught my attention of what just what you were talking about was we've changed our brains. I'm not convinced we've done it in a way that is positive. So I use this example all the time when I talk about technology. Aeroplanes are on autopilot for almost 90 to 95% of the flight. And it's the pilot that takes it off and lands it. And that's been digitized more and more over the years. Now, it's not that, it's quite analogous to a sat nav in your car. You're driving the car, you're getting directions. And you'll all remember when sat-navs first came out, and as they got sort of more intellectual, kind of people kind of just deferring thinking to the sat-nav while they get on and do other things, have a shape in the mirror, sort of just blindly follow what it says because they didn't need to read a map because they were going to trust in this thing. And the key difference between these two is that what pilots do is they train for the moment the technology fails. And they respond to that. They are responsive. They are adaptive. The moment it fails, they go into alert mode. They're trained to do that in relation to the technology. We as consumers don't do that. We as consumers pick up the latest bit of technology, consume it into our lives, and move on, loving the newfound freedom it's given us. But the moment we aren't able to use it, we're in a quandary. We're like, oh, what do we do? We're in a panic. And so we might have adopted these new practices, but actually we haven't learned how to leverage them and not also keep our thinking sharp. And this is where I think digital transformation as a whole is a dangerous general move for most organizations, is they're losing that thinking, that adaptability in their thinking, because what they're doing is they're automating process. And process is low value. But when it goes wrong, you need someone to sit in the middle. It's why customer experience. I know, Mick, you put it as one of your topics you wouldn't mind. The customer experience, the employee experience. Like, we're trying to digitize that. But what we're really doing, or what most organizations are doing, is sort of trying to remove the human, try and make things joined up more quickly. But when it requires a human touch, they're failing to address that. And that's sort of a downside, I think, of most digital transformations at the moment. But that's the bit that's getting me at the moment. It's like, how are we changing our response, and how are we adopting, and how are we understanding our own behavior to technology, and what are change professionals doing when it comes to organizations? Because, yeah, I'd pick up a new phone tomorrow and I'd just start using it, right? I wouldn't need someone to tell me.
I went, another part of the digital transformation thing, I think, is, Is it necessary to say you're going to do a digital transformation, or is it necessary to try that? And this is just a really an example. Well, I went to the DTX conference last year, and I sat and watched a brilliant presentation. He was the, I can't remember the guy's name now, I'll find it. He was the CTO for Lego. Now, I'm a massive, I used to play with Lego when I was a kid, but as I love making the adult Lego now, especially the, they're there, look, Kate's got loads of it. So, and my kids love making Lego, right? And what they talked about, he was talking about the digital transformation that Lego had to go in. I mean, it was very impressive. I mean, everything was, they're putting AI-enabled Lego blocks together. They're putting, you know, all the instructions, going away from paper instructions to doing it on an iPad. And my question to him at the end was, that doesn't work for me because I play with Lego or I build Lego because of I'm touching it and I'm building it and you make a mistake. And I'd see it with my children. They're forced now to use an iPad constantly to look at the instructions to build Lego. And my thing was, I don't want my kids to, I'm trying to get my kids. It's important that kids do that, but not all the time. And it seems like we're maybe forcing people into that situation as well, when that may not necessarily be the best thing to do. Because it's, you know, everyone's got to go down this digital route. And for a lot of people, it's stressful. You see, I don't know, especially in the UK now, the amount of like high street banks that are closing, and they're trying to force pensioners down the route of, you're going to have a smartphone to do online banking. I mean, it's a scary thought for a lot of people. Are we really considering all the people within that digital transformation, if that's what we're going to call it? Because for some people, it's just not, it's not feasible for them.
Yeah, and I going back to kind of a customer experience point, I think there is almost a tacit knowledge of the fact you're not going to get everyone, but hey, that,
yeah,
my business to, I need to turn this into a low cost process, and digital transformation is my way to do that. And unfortunately, there will be some casualties, is probably the wrong word, but you know, there will be people that won't make the change. We'll make it harder for them, you know, and it won't be the same experience you or I perhaps had or would like. And they'll lose customers perhaps, but then when the wider ecosystem is also changing to be more like that, maybe unfortunately we've become part of the dinosaur category and not moving with the times. It's an interesting one though, isn't it?
This is where, to your link about the customer experience, I think also that organizations that rely on perhaps their executive, for example, to represent the voice of the customer versus the true voice of the customer, it becomes an interesting disaggregation. And how many times have we heard an exec say, oh, I'd never use that. Oh, I don't like the way that is, versus, you know, what do the customers think? How do the customers, you know, have the customers used it? Where are they finding it challenging to use? And really stepping outside of our own technology biases or predispositions and being able to just truly embrace that voice of the customer and the behavior of the customer, and then taking hold of that. And an area where I think that's going to be really interesting is the whole area of age tech, because we'll have a generation of users who were perhaps light users, so maybe got a smartphone in their 70s, maybe a little bit of this or that, that their kids maybe forced them into it, or their grandkids. And yet, in terms of enablement, one of the richest areas of opportunity So imagine if I was in a senior care home and didn't actually need to try to keep track of my keys or manage trying to get the key into that tiny lock because it would just open because it knew it was me. And it's that kind of customer-centric enablement and the opportunity that it represents for society and for us as change practitioners that I think is just incredibly exciting and part of our journey ahead.
Yeah. I mean, I'm interested to go back to that topic of we don't call it digital transformation necessarily when we're talking to the people in the business. One of the things I think it's been talked about for such... I remember doing an event when I used to lead the UK London team. I did an event on what is digital transformation back in 2016. Wow. And what I walked away thinking was, a bit like you said, Yvonne, right, that this is just a badge to something that's happening already. But for some reason, we decided to call it out as something specific like this, you know, over here, we're doing digital stuff there. You're just doing technology. For some reason, we decided to make this distinction. And then secondarily, actually, a lot of it was about, you know, at least we're back then, I was thinking, okay, so technology is just the enabler of new ways for people to work. So where's the bit that's talking about that? So digital transformation is talking about what the technology can do, but it can't do it without the people. So, and I'm interested. So, to you know, your experience, you talked about kind of implementing ChatGPT at the moment, Mick. Like, how relevant is the moniker of digital transformation versus what are we using it to do for the business that's different? Because there's a lot of cynicism from the people I speak to at the front of most businesses around, oh, here comes another transformation, digital or otherwise. Right. So,
yeah, I mean, the whole thing, the whole AI stuff is, well, it's scary for a lot of people, isn't it? You know, you just got to be honest. It's a lot of people go straight to, I want to leave my job. It's not that's sort of a place people can go to quite quickly, but there's this sort of principle around human machine teaming. It's you have to have a human in this system somewhere to make the best use of the AI. Let's take large language model. Let's take ChatGPT. I mean, I'd be quite interested actually to just, I don't know if you can do a show of hands or who's actually had a go at using it, for instance. So, yeah, there's a few people that have had a... I mean, it's like anything. It's like Kat said about, you know, if I go out and buy a phone tomorrow, right, you've got enough knowledge of the other phone that you had previously that, do you know what, you can pick it up and you can almost have a go. And that's almost how I explain to people that just go and have a play with what it is. It's almost the best way I can explain or how I use it. It's like an assistant that doesn't ever stop. And actually I've been speaking to a team I work with, and there's three of us, and I've almost sort of said, well, there's actually four of us, because the other thing that's with us is this AI enabled system. So it's actually part of the team, but it's not replacing us as human beings, because it's got a terrible thing. They call it hallucinations, where it just makes stuff up. So you have to have people in there to check that this is actually going. And you don't want to be, believe me, you don't want to be the person that's just relying on that to do all your work for you, because you will get found out very, very quickly. But it's definitely something to be aware of. And I don't think it's going to... Of course, there's going to be jobs that get... Look, there's jobs that are going to exist for my children that I wouldn't even be able to tell you what they are. In fact, no one knew what a prompt engineer was until about 10 months ago, because that's now a job. because of ChatGPT. So again, and unless you sort of have a go at this, just try and see how you can use it. I think you're going to be a little bit in the dark, and that's where, so someone's put there, you know, how you overcome the resistance. I think it's literally trying, just start having a play with it. That would be my recommendation, and start building your skills so you can try and allay that fear in other people. I don't see it as a threat as such. I see it as an opportunity, to be honest.
When I think back to when calculators and Excel spreadsheets were first introduced, I remember the first time I took stats, and it was all longhand. I think you could use a calculator. And then the second time I studied stats, it was through enabled software. And in that journey, people talked about, oh, nobody's going to know how to do math anymore because we've got these tools. So I think what was different at that time, so now we're facing the same thing on the language side as we did on the math side. I think what is different is that the evolution has been faster. Like, it's felt like it's gone from a world without ChatGPT to a world with ChatGPT in a very, very compressed period of time, versus the evolution that came with, you know, first of all, calculators, then scientific calculators, then spreadsheets, then more sophisticated spreadsheets. And so perhaps part of it is that journey of just, you know, that it's not being internalized before another enhancement or application is being discovered. But to that end, where would we be without our calculators? And yet, how many times have we use spreadsheets or calculators, looked at it and thought, that number's not right, and then gone back in and our formula was wrong or something like that. So it's using your brain in a different way.
And I think that is a really, really important point. I think, Mick, you kind of were kind of getting at that, right? I did a talk a couple of months back at Project Challenge, which is a conference here in the UK, and it was talking about trends the CMI had pulled together. And one of the things was kind of incorporating AI into our work. And I'd asked the audience, you know, who's used ChatGPT and how would you use it in the work you do? And some people were going, well, I got it to write me a base business case for a particular type of change. And then I took that and I kind of edited bits and I kind of read through it and I made it my own, but it kind of did the work. I used it to help me make a project plan for something that was sort of relatively vanilla, you know. And I think what the rhetoric again is, people will just default to using this in replacement of. I mean, the education sector is really key in this, right? Like, where students will just go and type in the question verbatim, copy out the answer, submit that, and the tutors can't tell the difference between, in most cases. I mean, if people want to get away with doing that for a while, do it. But in respect, you're cheating yourself, right? Because you haven't learned anything. You've simply regurgitated something for an answer. So I think, as you said, education, the reinforcement of the critical thinking that goes into supporting using these tools, right? Does it make sense? Is it logical? Does it sit with what I know? Are there independent sources I can verify it with? These are all really important things to keep your brain active. Going back to that kind of behavior changes, we can't lose our curiosity and our inquisitiveness about what's being told to us. But what it does do is it harnesses a great amount of information we've got inability to kind of gather. And this is where, I mean, maybe that's a place to move on to now. Like, you know, how are we digitizing change management? I think Dat Sky kind of mentioned that at the beginning of the talk before we got on. I think we are probably a profession who, if I'm brutally honest, is sort of in itself struggling to digitize itself and leverage tools and try and leverage data and sort of start to make holistic improvements to the way we deliver the work we do. So I think there's the important thing with ChatGPT is it's there, it's accessible, try it, there's no harm, but think about how you're using it. But then, you know, other examples of how we're digitizing the delivery of change management. I'd be really keen to hear what you guys are up to if you've got.
Yeah, no, I totally agree, mate. It's that age old problem, isn't it? It's Yeah, but show me. I don't know if any, you know, you get a senior and you go in there and you say, you know, this is, we need to do this because of this, and these people don't seem to be on board with it. And it's, you know, where's data? Well, show me then. And it's that thing about what can we as change people actually use to show people? And I'll give you a very, very brief overview of something I've been doing. And it's, I'm sure people have come across Dave Snowden. He's got something called a Human Sensor Network, and he's got a really, really powerful tool called SenseMaker. Really, really good. But there's ways you can sort of do that yourself. And I, with a couple of, I'm not technical. All right, that's the other thing. I'm not a coder. I'm not a data scientist, anything like that. And I don't think you need to be either in these situations when you're looking at this stuff from a change angle at all. But yeah, with a couple of tech guys, I've been doing sentiment analysis on qualitative data in AWS to actually try and get some of this data to show the sentiment, and then over time show where the workforce seem you implement something, you gather little sort of these narratives from people, so they're almost journaling on a weekly, fortnightly basis. I'm not going to say this is easy, but it's a way to do it. And you're gathering this information all the time, and over a period of time, you can see how the sentiment goes compared to what you're actually trying to do, and you can get a really good picture of what's happening. And it's certainly on a little dashboard. And the thing is, I always say to people, they go straight to the dashboard. Oh, that dashboard looks brilliant, and you're like, forget the dashboard. It's just the dashboard. It's actually the information people are putting into it. But I've been using AWS to try to bring some of this data to life for people, because I certainly get frustrated when people say, oh, I don't believe what it's at. You can't show me anything, you know?
Yeah.
So
if I'm thinking more directly about the impact our practice, I think that's where you talked about the speed of change. Speed of input is definitely relevant. It's used to be we do one survey at the start and end of project. We call that feedback. Then we moved to monthly town halls, and we thought that was something. And now it's the in-the-moment inputs that we gain either through discussion or through actual utilization that really starts to make us reflect on things like change impact assessments and change adoption in a different way. And I even think about stakeholder engagement. I mean, at one time, if you built a rock solid PowerPoint, that would carry you a long way. Well, now it's you know, you're always looking for what is that next thing that's really going to make a difference based on my stakeholder audiences and based on how it needs to be tailored all the way through from early adopters through to those that are the most resistant to change, and try to call with your sponsor support of not everybody's going to change. We know that every time we go into a change. And so then what do we want to do with the outliers? And being able to actually measure and know how many outliers there really are and what the impact of them not joining the journey really is.
To you, I put myself as guilty, but I'm fortunate. I'll give that admission now. But I'd studied math, so I'm perhaps less guilty. Do you think just the kind of nature that most change practitioners are, very behavior, very psychologically focused, very, you know, non-process, that we ourselves are pushing against trying to digitize our practice? It's almost like we are our own resistors to modernizing the way we work.
I don't know. I think of most of the practitioners I interact with is actually embracing the best of linear and lateral thinking simultaneously. So moving between strategy and tactic almost in an instant and back again, being able to see how the tactic lines up with the strategy and inferring almost immediately what sort of tactics might deliver against a strategy. So that nimbleness of thought and positioning with stakeholders is when I sit back and look at change practitioners I work with and I go, wow, you nailed that. It was something fluid about the way that they approached it that really made the best of their reality.
And I agree. Sorry, but maybe just to clarify, I'm talking about, say, actually adopting better data analysis in our practice, really understanding how numbers and data work and how you can better leverage it for your messaging. You know, people might be uncomfortable dealing with data and working, you know, with sort of, you know, more advanced ways of presenting data and storytelling and all those things with graphics, because there's a learning to it and you know what you know. So I was going at it in terms of my own practice. My practice hasn't really changed. I still do similar approaches, Excel, maybe the odd kind of graphical presentation where it, you know, it makes sense to tell the story, but there's so much more out there to do.
Yeah.
If we collected the data and managed it better and we got involved in it, but I don't see us making that move.
Me personally, this is what I feel about working within change and tying into some of the stuff you said there, Kat, is I think we're very fortunate because there's an awful lot you can bring to change without people necessarily saying to you, I don't think that's anything that's got anything to do with your, you know, if I came in and said, I've got this data and I'd really like to show it this way, or do you know what? I've seen this thing around psychology and, oh, there's this project management thing that I know about. I think we're fortunate in change that we can bring a lot of that into a lot of this thing. And, you know, just from like everyone on this call, we get the opportunity to work across such a broad range of different areas. You know, from AI, you know, the last thing I was doing, I was working the PMO. Do you know what I mean? We're always doing lots of different things. Just, yeah. I like picking up. Yeah, I see myself, and I don't know, almost like a generalist is how I'm not a complexity scientist, but I love complexity. But that's not going to stop me talking about those things because I've got an interest in it. I think we're quite lucky from a change perspective that we can, if we want, bring an awful lot of stuff to the profession. You've just got to want to have that curiosity to do it, I suppose.
Yeah.
And to that point, Nick, I think at one time we knew that we could be good in training, informed about communications, but that we could also tap into experts that were expert communicators and expert training folks that we collaborate with and work with and help to move a change. Now those experts have extended to places like UXD experts, so interface design experts, and data visualization from change adoption perspectives. So even though we ourselves might not be able to produce the Kurubius like three-dimensional dynamic data visualization output of our change adoption, we know people who do. And so, sure. And we don't hesitate to tap into them. And so that ability as a generalist that continue to draw on this broader reach of experts, I think is absolutely remarkable.
Yeah. I want to pick up on a point Tracy and Kate both mentioned, kind of they really feel like, data and information is something that it could massively add value to the way we communicate. I think that's kind of generally the sentiment. But I recently just, so one of the collaborations we've been doing is working with Birkbeck University here in the UK, working with their MSc students to do research projects. And one of the topics we presented on last May, May just gone, was how do you measure the impact of change and demonstrate its value? And you know, like this was a really difficult topic for a lot of people. Everybody kind of naturally just went to what is the benefit of change management? Not how do you measure? They went to the easier question, right? And then we had to bring them back and kind of go, no, I get you know what the benefit is, but how can you measure it? What is there that you can hang your hat on? And so we kind of got into this sort of murky area of like, well, you know, why is measuring important? Measuring is important because we need to show often to a senior level the impacts we're having are going in a direction we expect them to, and that we can kind of show we're making progress. And how do we do that? Well, I mean, in my practice, often what I do is I spend quite a bit of time with line managers and people within operations saying, what numbers are important to you? How do you know what good looks like in your day-to-day work? Because I suspect something's going to happen to those numbers when we start to implement change in your areas. So how can we start to use them as barometers of the way change is working and use them to kind of direct the way we then support post-implementation? So if we roll out a new system and your number of reports released every month in 5 days goes down from 100 to 80 in the first month of rollout, hey, guess what? We've had an impact on the business and how efficient they are. Now, that might go up to 120, but it's going to require us to direct our focus. So I think there's this worry that we have to come up with new metrics to measure what we're doing. And actually what I would kind of get people to focus on is say, well, what metrics exist that the business care about that are likely to have an impact by what we do? And then let's work closely to see how we can connect the two up, because ultimately that is our barometer. And I think we don't have to do, I think we in our, I'm guilty of it. We in ourselves overcomplicate how difficult it is to get into measuring what we do. Now, we can't be explicit. I can't say because I took this action, that number changed. But I can say indicatively, we knew that that number might change. And look, it did. So complexity, there's a load of other things going on. But, you know, we've got something as a yardstick. And I think that is important. Do you guys do anything like that? Look at measurements of, you know, what operations teams are using?
Well, go on, Yvonne.
I actually was going to throw it to you, Vic, because in our pre-chat, we talked about business strategy, and that this digital stuff isn't in absence of where the business itself needs or wants to go. So that to me, that's exactly kind of what Kat sort of get that. So I'm going to throw it to you, Mick.
Yeah, I mean, the measurement is, it can be hard, can't it? I tend to try to work with business analysts as well, because they are very good at like getting a lot of this information from when they're, you know, gathering requirements, and they're really looking at that type of stuff. And maybe sometimes, instead of us thinking we're the people that have got to come up with the measurements, maybe some of these measurements already exist as well, and we might not be as tied into business analysts, for instance, than we could be. I think it might save us a lot of time as well, and a lot of pain, because it is. I'm trying to think of that book that I'm sure it's called something like "You Can Measure Anything" or something like that. I've got it up in my office. I'll find the link and put it on Amazon, but that's quite a good read, because you can, the guy breaks it down quite easy. You can measure anything. I'm not going to say it makes sense, but yeah, but it's not an easy thing. But again, yeah, tying it into, if you're, you know, a business strategy, I get, you know, you can make a business strategy that's 2 years, you know, it's a 2 year thing. I think most people know now that is it's almost like a sense of direction, because look at the pace of AI, right? I can almost, this time last year, it'd be really interesting if you could possibly do it as if it was a hypothesis, to see how many businesses actually pulled out the impact AI might have on their business strategy. I don't, some will have, but a company like the company I work for, you know, fairly small management consultancy. It's not something we were overly talking about, but this year it'll be something that we're talking about. So that the pace of this stuff as well. And I think that's why you've got to be keeping an eye out for this, because you can have a 2-year business strategy and you might be able to measure against that, but the speed of things are advancing. It's like this continuous feedback, which Yvonne was talking about just now. I know Kat's talking about this a lot as well. And that's why I was doing that sense maker, you know, the sort of sense maker thing it's the continuous feedback. So you can actually make a decision on information as you get it, instead of thinking that you're just going to go from A to B. It's almost like a bit of, like rock. I used to do a lot of rock climbing. I think of it like rock climbing almost. You know, you're going to get to the top, and you don't just climb straight up the face. You end up going in all sorts of directions, but you end up getting to the top. Yeah, it's the whole strategy thing is really interesting. Now, I think we're going to have to really, really shorten change strategies as well when we look at things. Doing things 2-5 years in advance is almost, it's almost sort of crystal ball stuff now, I think, in some way. I don't know what anybody else thinks.
I think there's a danger that this stuff is moving so quickly and we're sort of so on the periphery of it. We learn about it from the fact our clients start to think about it. And actually, we need to get ahead of the game. So how do we do that? How do we show an interest in the trends that are coming that are outside of change management? We always talk about kind of trends that are shaping change management. Well, actually, what are the trends that are shaping the reason organizations are changing? And what are we doing to avail ourselves of the information? I think that isn't easy for people. Again, great use of ChatGPT, right? Like, ask it a question. What trends should I learn about in the next 6 months, right, when it comes to business change? And then spend a bit of time. So I think we're in danger of sort of struggling with the information overload and not using tools to help us and sticking to the way we work. And the problem is that's a slow, as we all know, right, from every other organization that ever works like that, is it's a slow decline to your capability because other people come in who have already natively learned this. So I think that's part of the challenge of being in change at the moment is, yeah, the technology, you're right, Mick, is moving so swiftly. We haven't even got time to think about what's coming for us, let alone for organizations. So I think there's definitely some work to be done there.
Really good conversation, guys. We had quite a few messages in the chat. I don't know if you've had a chance to have a quick look through, but we've got 6 minutes left. So that hour has just flown by. I wanted to just give you an opportunity to maybe give us some final thoughts before we close the call for today. Yvonne, did you want to start?
Sure. And yes, we certainly have been trying to integrate some of the thoughts that have been reflected in the chat through our conversations, maybe not specifically, but certainly picking up on the themes. And the one piece that I will close with is that need for our own continuous learning, natural curiosity, like diving ourselves into uncomfortable situations so that we ourselves can learn and grow as individual practitioners, and then contributing and paying that back to the practice as well. So some great tools mentioned in the chat. Some I haven't heard of, some I certainly have, but it even something like that gives me a great path to follow through and look for some additional learning opportunities.
So, Kat?
There's a good one, Yvonne. Yeah, but you got in there first. I think my takeaway is sort of rising above the rhetoric and this constant focus on digital transformation. It's how the C-suite talk for sure. We've got to be comfortable around it, but actually, and I think a lot of people are doing this already if you're in change, right? Like, what does it mean for you? How do we make that real? How can we be well-versed, to Yvonne's point, how can we be well-versed in what's happening for people so that we can actually be a better support to them? Those are the things that really, for me, make the difference. Kind of the titles, to some extent, become irrelevant again, to Yvonne's earlier point around. So, yeah, I think that's it.
No worries. So, thank you, Kat. Mick?
This is now difficult. Now, I think you can't be passive. You cannot afford to be passive anymore. You've really got to be proactive. And it's something I've been saying to a lot of, like, change is a doing activity in my book. You have to go out there. I think the days of sort of sitting behind an Excel spreadsheet, updating a stakeholder matrix and saying you work and change, those days are sort of gone, really. You really do. You want to be a sort of magpie going out there and finding these little things that you can get hold of and just make little, you know, just do little things to try and get a little bit more understanding for yourself. Because if you're the person that can go and find a person that can show your change work in a data insights, well, you know, you've made a win, really.